Profiles of Today's Youth. They couldn't care less. John Karras, 28 years old, was in a card shop the other day as the radio, which provides the soundtrack for his generation, offered a report on the dead and missing in the floods that had just flashed through southeastern Ohio. The cashier, a man a bit younger than Mr. Karras, looked up at the radio and said, "I wish they'd stop talking about it. I'm sick of hearing about it." Mr. Karras, a doctoral student in education at Ohio State, recalled this incident to illustrate what he sees as a pervasive attitude among the members of his generation toward the larger world. "The typical young person doesn't want to hear about it unless it's knocking on my door." The findings of two national studies concur. The studies, one released today and the other late last year, paint a portrait of a generation of young adults from 18 to 29 years of age who are indifferent toward public affairs. It is a generation that, as the Times Mirror Center for the People and the Press put it in a report released today, knows less, cares less, votes less, and is less critical of its leaders and institutions than young people in the past. "My teacher told me, always question authority," said Paul Grugan, 22, one of the two dozen young people interviewed this week by the New York Times in this mid-sized city in the middle of the country. "You can question authority, but you can burden authority. Let them do their job." The indifference of this generation to politics, to government, even to news about the outside world, is beginning to affect American politics and society, the reports suggest, helping to explain such seemingly disparate trends as the decline in voting, the rise of tabloid television, and the effectiveness of negative advertising. While apathy and alienation have become a national plague, the disengagement seems to run deeper among young Americans, those 18 to 29, setting them clearly apart from earlier generations. No one has yet offered a full explanation for why this should be so. The lack of mobilizing issues is part of the answer, as are the decline of the family and the rise of television. Young people themselves mention the weakness of their civic education, and they talk incessantly of stress, their preoccupation with getting jobs or grades, and their concern about personal threats like AIDS and drugs. "There are a lot more pressures on them than there were on us," said 48-year-old Ron Zeller, who talked about the differences along with his 22-year-old daughter, Susan, and his 18-year-old son, John. The study by Times Mirror, a public opinion research center supported by Times Mirror Company, looked at 50 years of public opinion data and concluded, "Over most of the past five decades, younger members of the public have been at least as well informed as older people. In 1990, that is no longer the case." This concern was echoed in a second report, prepared last year by People for the American Way, a liberal lobby and research organization, which concluded that there is a citizenship crisis in which America's youth are alarmingly ill-prepared to keep democracy alive in the 1990s and beyond. The decline in voting is one illustration of how what seems to be a general problem is, in fact, most heavily concentrated among the young. Surveys by the Census Bureau show that since 1972, almost all of the decline in voting has been among those under 45, and that the sharpest drop is among those between 18 and 25. Among the elderly, voting has risen, according to the Census Bureau surveys. Older people, more settled than the young, have always participated more in elections. But the gap has widened substantially. In 1972, half of those between 18 and 24 said they voted, as did 71% of those 45 to 64, a gap of 21 percentage points. In 1988, 36% of the 18 to 24-year-olds, and 68% of the 45 to 64-year-olds said they voted, a gap of 32 percentage points. Shonda Wolf, 24, who has waited on tables since dropping out of college, said she had voted only once when she was 18 and still living at home. "I guess my mother was there to push me," she said. Now, she said, she does not pay much attention to politics or to the news. "I try to avoid it, all the controversy," she said. "It just does not interest me at this point in my life. I'd rather be outside doing something, taking a walk." Not one of the young people interviewed in Columbus at the Street Scene Restaurant and the Short North Tavern had a good word to say about politics or politicians. But unlike older people, who often express anger about news about sloth or corruption in government, these young people seem simply to be reporting it as a well-known fact. "Most politicians are liars," said Deborah Roberts, a 29-year-old secretary. People for the American Way, in its report, noted that young people seemed to have a half-formed understanding of citizenship, stressing rights but ignoring responsibilities. When asked to define citizenship, Shonda Wolf said it meant the right not to be harassed by the police. She cited as an intrusion on her rights the security guard's insistence at a concert that she and her boyfriend stop turning on their cigarette lighters. Nancy Radcliffe Spurgeon, 24, a student at Ohio State, said she thought that many of the attitudes of her generation were based on feeling safe. "It's easy to isolate yourself when you think things are going pretty well for you, so you don't rock the boat." Occasionally, someone in the interview would mention voting. None of the young people, when asked about citizenship, included in their definition of good citizenship running for office, attending a community board meeting, studying an issue, signing a petition, writing a letter to the governor, or going to a rally. Certain issues do get their attention, almost always involving government interference in personal freedoms. They generally favor access to abortion, and a few of the young people were upset by efforts to cut off federal funds for artworks deemed obscene. Andrew Coet, director of surveys for Times Mirror, said there was a new generation gap, in which those under 30 were separated by their lack of knowledge and interest from those over 30. "People in their 30s and 40s are disenchanted with the world, but remain aware," said Mr. Coet. "But those under 30," he said, "are not so much disillusioned as disinterested." New words: abortion, alarmingly, alienation, apathy, bureau, census, concur, corruption, disenchanted, disengagement, disillusioned, disinterested, disparate, doctoral, election, harass, illustration, insistence, intrusion, mobilize, obscene, pervasive, petition, profile, settled, sloth, soundtrack, tabloid, tavern, widen. Me, Stuart, Mom, and Dad. On Saturday, I introduced my parents to Stuart. After he'd left, I went back into the kitchen to ask my parents what they thought of him. Perhaps I'm old-fashioned, or maybe I'm just looking for criticism. But I always like my parents to meet my boyfriends. I think it's good for both parties. If nothing else, it enables me to see the guy from a different point of view, and it tells me whether I'm onto a good thing or not. Boys tend to divide into two categories where my parents are concerned. They either shrink into themselves and leave me to do the talking, or else they'll be really outgoing and confident and stand up well to the interrogation. On the whole, I like the second type best.
especially those who aren't afraid to give their own opinions. I haven't subjected many shy ones to the torture, because I like boys who have something to say for themselves. And anyway, it's embarrassing. Stuart definitely falls into category two. He's very outspoken, offensive even, and he'll argue about anything just for the sake of arguing. He also criticizes, and with my parents, he picked on private education. My sister's at a private school, and he challenged my parents on it. I thought my mother was going to die on the spot. Still, he likes his opinions to be known, and I don't think he really upset anyone. Although he was a bit rude to my parents, I didn't feel angry with him because, as I said, I like people to be confident in that way. And also because, for some perverse reason, I like it if my parents don't like the people I associate with. I'm not quite sure why I feel like this. Perhaps I unconsciously try to widen the gap between my parents and me. I do, I think, do things which I know they disapprove of, because it makes me feel more free from them. My parents represent everything that is ordinary about life, and I want to be different from them. I'll probably grow out of it. I'm not saying that I'm entirely motivated by a desire to displease my parents, but it does come into a lot of things. For instance, I go on a lot of political demonstrations. I don't just go to annoy them. I believe very strongly in the causes, but it's a way of showing my parents that I can look after myself. I like the feeling that I have a voice of my own, and that hundreds of people share my opinions. The last march I went on was in October, and it was the biggest ever in Britain. It'll go down in history, and I was there. That's really fantastic, a lovely feeling of power. But I'm getting off the subject, Stuart and my mother and father, Ma and Pa, or whatever. They didn't actively dislike him, but they kind of warned me about him. They said not to take anything he said too seriously, especially his political views. That annoyed me, because I like to feel that nobody influences me, especially someone like Stuart. I have always been slightly suspicious of people who are completely, in every respect, radically left-wing. I don't think they ever consider their ideas and their implications properly. Anyway, I told my parents that nobody influences me, but I know it was a lie, because every person you're close to influences you in some way. Especially when you're young and the other person is like Stuart, a very strong character. They were careful not to be too critical. They hedged delicately and did not mention anything which I would say was irrelevant, like his appearance. Although they didn't like his views, I think, in a way, they liked how he talked. He's very articulate, and I know he's clever. So they'll let me carry on seeing him, and like everything else, he'll be an escape for me. He'll stand for what I'd like to be. I don't admire his principles and motives, but I admire his courage because I can never really break away from my comfortable, safe, boring family. If I associate with people who have broken away, do things that they do, maybe I'll convince someone that I am different. Maybe one day I'll really get away. But I'll more likely just, as I said, grow out of it. I'll probably get married, have kids, and I'll watch them and try to shelter them the way my parents do for me. But maybe they'll be all right. Perhaps they'll be the ones that change the world and all that. We've got the right ideas, but we haven't got the willpower. It's not important enough. Perhaps my kids will be different. I hope so, because I just don't care. New words. Articulate. Displease. Embarrassing. Interrogation. Irrelevant. Motive. Mum. Pa. Perverse.
College pressures. I desperately need a dean's excuse for my chemistry midterm, which will begin in about 1 hour. All I can say is that I wasted this week. I've fallen incredibly, inconceivably behind. Help! I'm anxious to hear from you. I'll be in my room and won't leave until I hear from you. Tomorrow is the last day for... probably by Friday. I'll be able to get back to my studies. Right now, I'm going to take a long walk. This whole thing has taken a lot out of me. Who are these miserable people, making urgent requests for help, scribbling notes so laden with anxiety? They are men and women who belong to Branford College, one of the 12 residential colleges at Yale University. And the messages are just a few of hundreds that they left for their dean, Carlos Hortas, often slipped under his door at 4 a.m. But students, like the ones who wrote those notes, can also be found on campuses from coast to coast. Nobody could doubt that the notes are real. In their urgency and their gallows humor, they are authentic voices of a generation that is panicky to succeed. My own connection with the message writers is that I am a master of Branford College. I live on the campus and know the students well. If they went to Carlos to ask how to get through tomorrow, they come to me to ask how to get through the rest of their lives. Mainly, I try to remind them that the road ahead is a long one and that it will have more unexpected turns than they think. There will be plenty of time to change jobs, change careers, change whole attitudes and approaches. They don't want to hear such liberating news. They want a map, right now, that they can follow unswervingly to career security, financial security, social security, and presumably, a prepaid grave. What I wish for all students is some release from the threatening grip of the future. I wish them a chance to savor each segment of their education as an experience in itself and not as a grim preparation for the next step. I wish them the right to experiment, to trip and fall, to learn that defeat, instructive as victory, is not the end of the world. My wish, of course, is naive. One of the few rights that America does not proclaim is the right to fail. Achievement is the national god. Worshipped in our media, the million-dollar athlete, the wealthy executive, and glorified in our praise of possessions. In the presence of such a potent state religion, the young are growing up old. In the late 1960s, one dean told me, the typical question that I got from students was, "Why is there so much suffering in the world?" Or, "How can I make a contribution?" Today, it's, "Do you think it would be better for getting into law school if I did a double major in history and political science, or just majored in one of them?" Note the emphasis on looking better. The transcript has become a sacred document, the passport to security. How one appears on paper is more important than how one appears in person. A is for admirable, and B is for borderline, even though in Yale's official system of grading, A means excellent and B means very good. Today, looking very good is no longer good enough, especially for students who hope to go on to law school or medical school. They know that entrance into the better schools will be an entrance into the better law firms and better medical practices where they will make a lot of money. They also know that the odds are harsh. Yale Law School, for instance, accepts 170 students from an applicant pool of 3,700. Harvard enrolls 550 from a pool of 7,000. The pressure is almost as heavy on students who just want to graduate and get a job. Long gone are the days when students journeyed through college with a certain relaxation, sampling a wide variety of courses, music, art, philosophy, classics, poetry, that would send them out as liberally educated men and women. If I were an employer, I would rather employ graduates who have this range and curiosity than those who narrowly pursued safe subjects and high grades. I know countless students whose inquiring minds excite me. I like to hear their ideas. I don't know if they are getting A's or C's, and I don't care. I also like them as people. The country needs them, and they will find satisfying jobs. I tell them to relax. They can't. Nor can I blame them. They live in a brutal economy. Today, it is not unusual for a student, even if he works part-time at college and full-time during the summer, to have $5,000 in loans after 4 years, loans that he must start to repay within 1 year after graduation. How could he not feel under pressure throughout college to prepare for this day of reckoning? Along with economic pressure goes parental pressure. Inevitably, the two are deeply intertwined. I see many students taking pre-medical courses with joyless tenacity. They go off to their labs as if they were going to the dentist. It saddens me because I know them in other corners of their life as cheerful people. "Do you want to go to medical school?" I ask them. "I guess so," they say, without conviction, or, "Not really." "Then why are you going?" "Well, my parents want me to be a doctor. They're paying all this money and..." Poor students, poor parents. They are caught in one of the oldest webs of love and duty and guilt. The parents mean well. They are trying to steer their sons and daughters toward a secure future. But the sons and daughters want to major in history or classics or philosophy, subjects with no practical value. Where's the payoff on the humanities? It's not easy to persuade such loving parents that the humanities do indeed pay off. The intellectual faculties developed by studying subjects like history and classics, an ability to synthesize and relate, to weigh cause and effect, to see events in perspective, are just the faculties that make creative leaders in business or almost any general field. Still, many fathers would rather put their money on courses that point toward a specific profession, courses that are pre-law, pre-medical, pre-business, or, as I sometimes heard it put, pre-rich. Peer pressure and self-induced pressure are also intertwined, and they begin almost at the beginning of freshman year. I had a freshman student I'll call Linda, one dean told me, who came in and said she was under terrible pressure because her roommate, Barbara, was much brighter and studied all the time. I couldn't tell her that Barbara had come in 2 hours earlier to say the same thing about Linda. The story is almost funny, except that it's not. It's symptomatic of all the pressures put together. When every student thinks every other student is working harder and doing better, the only solution is to study harder still. I see students going off to the library every night after dinner and coming back when it closes at midnight. I hear the clacking of computer keyboards in the hours before dawn. I see the tension in their eyes when exams are approaching and papers are due. Will I get everything done? Probably they won't. They will get sick. They will get blocked. "Hey, Carlos, help." New words. Admirable. Applicant. Clack. Gallows. Grim. Hey. Inconceivably. Inquiring. Instructive. Intertwine. Joyless. Liberally. Loan. Midterm. Panicky. Payoff. Poetry. Prepaid. Reckoning. Residual. Sadden. Symptomatic. Tenacity. Transcript. Unswervingly. Urgent.
Postgraduate paralysis. Thousands of college graduates received their diplomas this year in fear or even embarrassment. They were not proud of themselves, nor eager to take on the real world. Instead, they thought of themselves as failures. These are the graduates who have not been offered fat salaries and generous benefits. They are the ones who won't be going to work as lawyers, investment bankers, and engineers. They have taken the right courses, gotten good grades, and gone through some on-campus job interviews. but because they weren't offered the perfect job, no, that exciting career, seemingly guaranteed to all those who make the right moves, they are sitting at home, victims of postgraduate paralysis. This may come as a surprise to anyone who has read about the fabulous job offers tendered to recent graduates. However, those of us who are parents of children in this age group know that such offers are relatively rare and that many liberal arts students graduate with the belief that the prospective workplace may not have a place for them. Consider my daughter. She graduated from college with a degree in economics 2 years ago. She was offered a job by a recruiter who came to her campus, but it was with a trucking firm in South Carolina as a dispatch management trainee. She turned it down. It was her parents' first clue that she had a problem. It seems economists don't work for trucking firms, nor do Midwestern children want to live in the South before they become arthritic. Yet even at home in Minneapolis, our daughter couldn't seem to find anything to apply for. Her father told her to make the rounds of the personnel agencies, but she was so horrified by the demeaning atmosphere at one that she refused to visit any others. Then one day, when she was looking at the Sunday paper and complaining that there was nothing in it, I told her there had to be something. "Look at this," I commanded, "and this, and this." I circled a number of jobs in the first two columns I skimmed. But Maureen protested, "I don't want to be an administrative assistant." It was then that her father and I realized that what she had been looking for in the paper was a career, not a job. And ever since, we have watched the children of friends suffer from this same delusion. No one, it seems, has told them that a career is an evolutionary process. When I graduated from college 25 years ago, I never expected to find a job that was in itself a career. In those days, we were told we knew nothing, but that upon graduation, we would have the tools to learn. And learn we did, on the job. I began by doing grunt work in the customer service department at National Geographic magazine. In due time, I wound up with a career. Indeed, owning and running a firm that publishes research reports for architects and real estate developers. Apparently, schools have changed their approach. Today's students are told they know everything in order to succeed in a career. Career talk often begins in seventh grade or earlier, and the career is offered as the reward one receives upon graduation. No one is satisfied with this system. Businesses complain that they get new graduates who are unhappy with anything less than high-level, decision-making jobs as their first assignment. And parents are shocked that the child without a job can graduate traumatized by the fear of rejection. As I see it, parents are a principal cause of the problem. Who among us hasn't thought, "What's wrong with that kid?" when we hear that a recent college graduate is a cashier at a grocery store because he can't find a job. At the same time, how many of us can put the screws on a son and convince him that he must abandon his idea of a career and take up the idea of finding work? This is a distasteful task, especially when we have shipped our children off to expensive colleges, believing that simply by footing the tuition bill, we are making them economically secure. The kids believe this, too, but the reality is that when they graduate, they are no more prepared for careers than we were. It is not a disgrace to go out and pound the pavement. I used just this expression the other day with my son's friend. Though he had graduated in December with a degree in philosophy, he has not yet found a job. He had never heard the saying before. He is bright, personable, and would do well in almost any kind of business. But he complains that he can't find work in the want ads. He has not visited any personnel agencies, and so he talks about going to law school instead. He was crushed by not having been recruited before graduation. This brings me back to my daughter. After some yelling and screaming by her parents, she did make the rounds of headhunters and found one who specialized in entry-level positions. This gentleman was wonderful. He helped her assess her skills and prepared her for interviews. She also read the newspapers and answered different types of ads. Not surprisingly, she got many responses. After a few weeks, she had the exhilarating experience of having 3 job offers at once. 2 were the products of answering newspaper ads, and 1 came through the headhunter's efforts. She landed an excellent position as an insurance underwriter, a job she didn't even know existed when she graduated. Happy in her job, Maureen also fell in love. And when she began to look for employment in Chicago, where she and her husband will live, she needed no help from her parents. She was confident and aggressive. She used headhunters, the want ads, her friends and ours. She had a new resource, business contacts. Yet as she was typing letters one day, I offered some sympathy about how hard it is to hunt for a job. "It's okay, Mom," she said. "This isn't like the first time. Now I know how to look for a job." And she found one as a senior underwriter. Now she'll make more money and more decisions. It's beginning to look like a career. New words: administrative, architect, arthritic, banker, crush, delusion, demeaning, diploma, disgrace, dispatch, distasteful, economically, estate, real estate, evolutionary, fabulous, grunt, headhunter, pavement, personable, postgraduate, screw, trainee, traumatized, trucking, underwriter.